Ian began her professional life at the ripe old age of 12 when she wrote her first song and was published by Broadside Magazine. That led to her first real show at New York's venerable Village Gate, where she shared a stage with Tom Paxton, Lou Gossett Jr., Judy Collins, Phil Oakes, and a host of other singer-songwriters. At 14, she wrote Society's Child, the name of her self-penned autobiography, and the topic of our talk today. From her first headlining show at Greenwich Village's Gaslight Cafe at age 15, her life has been fraught with challenges. Her debut single, Society's Child, focused on an interracial couple in an era when tempers flared even at a mention. The boos she received on stage from racists were accompanied by hate mail and death threats. She's lived through family problems, near-fatal health issues, failed relationships with both men and women, and devastating financial crises. Always one to follow her heart, Janice was one of the first celebrities to come out publicly. She and her partner of 23 years were married in Canada in 2003, the only place where gay marriage was legal at the time. Some of her career landmarks include, in 1976, she received 5 Grammy nominations, one of only 5 solo female artists to receive that many nominations in one year. Both Society's Child and At 17 have been inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. She sang the first Budweiser Light and Egg McMuffin commercials. And her songs have been recorded by singers as diverse as Cher, John Mellencamp, Celine Dion, Hugh Masekela, Charlie Daniels, and Roberta Flack. I am thrilled to have her as a guest on the show today. Welcome, Janice. It's so amazing to have you on the Book Report.
Elaine, thank you so much. I'm very pleased to be here.
First and foremost, I want to tell our readers that listening to you performing your audiobook feels like chatting with a friend. I want to congratulate you on that.
Ah, thank you. I think everybody was a little bit nervous going in. I know I was. I asked my producer, Stefan Rudnicki, to leave 5 days for it and an extra day for the music just in case. But after day one, he told me we were smooth sailing, and we actually finished it up in 4. And I tried to start each chapter with a quote from a song. So when it came time to do the book, when I was talking with Stefan, I said, I would really like to see whether we can meld the music with the book, because I think that would be a big difference between the static print book and the audio book. And he agreed to try it. He originally thought we were going to have to go into a special studio and whatnot, but we wound up doing a lot of it on the fly with me just reading with a guitar in my hands and then singing. Hmm. It was great. It was really, it was like when I do what we call a living room concert for my foundation, the Pearl Foundation, where I literally sit with a guitar in my hands in someone's living room and I tell stories of the songs and what went on behind them, the behind-the-scenes stuff, I guess. And then I sing the songs.
Well, you had your first hoot at age 13. What was that like for you at such a young age?
Well, it was great. I mean, it was what I'd wanted since I could remember. You know, I always dreamed that I would become a veterinarian and I would get to do music on the side. So getting to do music and then maybe being a veterinarian on the side was pretty cool. My first hoot had Tom Paxton and Eric Anderson, Phil Oakes, Buffy St. Marie, Judy Collins. Gosh, it was like a folk superstars afternoon. And at 13, you know, that's like your dream.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Hmm. Well, I loved reading that your inspiration for Society's Child came to you on a city bus. Share that story.
I was living in East Orange, New Jersey, which was at the time a pretty all-black neighborhood. I was one of 3 white girls in my class. And I was riding on the bus, going either home or somewhere else. And I saw a black and white couple, couldn't have been more than 16, 17 years old, holding hands, sitting on the bus. And they were oblivious, but everybody else on the bus was glaring at them, blacks and whites. And I realized that this was 1965, I guess, because I was 14. I realized that the glares were, in a sense, well-intentioned, but it was still going to be a very hard road. And the more I thought about it, the more it turned itself into a song.
Hmm. Well, I have kind of maybe a tough question for you. Knowing what you know now, if you had had children, would you have let them go on a major concert tour at age 15?
If they were the kind of children I was, there wouldn't have been much I could do about it.
Good answer.
Run away from home. You know, and going into music in my era in the 60s was like joining the circus was a century before. That's what you did when your dreams were too big to be contained. And I don't mean it to sound pretentious, but my teacher, Stella Adler, once said to us that we wanted to be in the theater not because we wanted to be famous, which is what all of us thought. But she said, there is something inside you too big to get out any other way. So I think when you have that kind of gift, when you're born with that kind of talent, you have to let it speak. And fortunately for me, I had a very encouraging family who allowed me to believe that I could be anything I wanted to be. And I had a wonderful library nearby where I could read stories of other kids and what they had become. So it wasn't so far-fetched for me. And I think nowadays, it wouldn't be so far-fetched for my kids.
Hmm.
Or my grandkids, for that matter, because my partner has a daughter.
Hmm. Well, you rubbed shoulders and performed with all the greats, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin, Bruce Springsteen. Can you give us a one or two quick reflections on that time?
I think I was very fortunate to come up in the 60s. There was a sense of solidarity because of everything that was going on. Vietnam and women's liberation, gay liberation, and 400 other things going on that united the under 30s. And in that sense, it was a great time to be hanging out with that crowd because there was a great blend of all of the different kinds of arts. You would have a Mapplethorpe working with a Patti Smith. You would have the Beatles working with an inventor. I feel bad for the next couple of generations because they missed out on something very heady and very exciting. And I think it's a lot harder now because it's so genre-specific. We were really working hard to break down those genres. Even in the book world, I mean, I get extremely confused by all the genres. I'm a huge science fiction fan, but now it's science fiction, and then there's fantasy, and then there's steampunk, and then there's William Gibson stuff. You know, it's all very, very separated. Mm-hmm. And I think that when the arts start getting separated within themselves and without from the other forms, creativity can't flourish in the same way.
Hmm.
So in that sense, I'm really grateful that I came up when I did.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like to appear on the first episode of Saturday Night Live?
I'll be honest, it was pretty strange and strained. Everybody was terrified. There hadn't been a live TV show since The Sullivan Show. So people were really scared because if anything went wrong, NBC had just taken this huge gamble that failed. I remember I had strep throat at the time, and I was flown in from the West Coast and got in that morning, went straight into rehearsals, met Andy Kaufman, said hey to Billy Preston, walked over to this huge papier-mâché mound where a couple of Muppets were arguing with each other and thought, oh, God, what have I gotten myself into? But it was a great show, you know, and I watched it the other year because I had never seen it. And I had forgotten just how cutting-edge George Carlin was and what a great choice.
Hmm. Wow. Now, you are wildly popular in Japan. How did that happen?
I was lucky enough to hit it at the right time with the right song. I had a song called Love is Blind that was picked as the first English-speaking and English-speaking artist song to basically be on a soap opera. It was a new soap opera about a samurai family, and it was really the rise of television in Japan, just a confluence of circumstances, and Sony Publishing, which had my publishing at the time, working very hard and taking some chances, and the soap caught on and the song caught on, and it was number one for a year. So it really gave me a whole different career than I have in the United States.
Hmm. And talk a little bit about your music today and what's ahead for you.
Good Lord. I'm on tour right now. And then I'm taking a lot of time next year to write my next album. I also have a children's book coming out in next September called The Tiny Mouse. That's a song that I wrote for the Olympics about a little mouse who goes away to sea but gets seasick and has to come home. And I'm working on a couple of short stories and a novel. I just signed with Curtis Brown, so that's a pretty cool thing to me. Gosh, I'm busy.
Yeah. Well, I want to tell readers and just kind of underscore how much I enjoyed your audiobook. I love the way you integrated the music. I love the way you talked to the readers and kind of brought us all in. This is one fabulous production. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, hey, thank you so much for asking. Yeah. I'm excited that you enjoyed it that much.
I really did. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.